Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Please like us on Facebook at Commentary. Follow us on Twitter at Commentary. I'm Jay Podhoretz on Twitter. With us, Abe Greenwald at Abe Greenwald on Twitter, our senior editor, and Noah Rothman, who is at Noah C. Rothman on Twitter. So you can follow him, you can follow Abe, you can follow me, you can follow Commentary. Welcome, guys. So we speak 12 hours into the news cascade, the Cosby-ish news cascade of, I think now, 10 women who all together have confirmed that when Donald Trump said in 2005 that he just like goes up and grabs women and kisses them and he can't help it, it's like a magnet, that in fact he did exactly that to them, as well as some other extremely distasteful things, like him saying to a 10-year-old girl, "I'm going to date you in 10 years," and walking in on the changing room of the Miss Teen USA pageant, theoretically, I guess, to get a glimpse of the Miss Teen USA's in various conditions of déshabille, as we say. So it's no secret that the three of us have some distaste for Donald Trump's personal conduct and views and all of that. The question is all of this baked in the cake? Has his lewd and gross behavior, something that has been dogging him or been part of his run since he started running in June 2015, will it drag him down further, or is there a floor because all of it is basically something that people have already taken account of and is already factored into their decision making? Something made him the most unpopular person ever to run for president, and certainly stuff like this is part of it. But Abe, are you of the view that Trump has farther to fall in the next 26 days?
I am, because he almost seems to want to fall farther. His claim that he's now unshackled was almost like an announcement of self-destruction. I mean, looking at the way it's played out since then. I mean, since he said he's unshackled, he's gone on a rampage, insinuating and accusing communities of potential voter fraud and certain GOP officials with possible collusion with the Democrats. He's getting uglier, which I think is only going to invite more women to come out of the woodwork, more accusations, and we haven't seen the floor yet.
I disagree with your motives, with your assessment of motives, rather. I don't think he's trying to...
I disagree with Abe's motives. In general, I'm often
Abe's motives are sterling. He is a paragon of virtue.
No, you and I are in deep disagreement about that.
I'll disagree
but that's
with
a
you
whole,
there as well.
That's a
I'll
whole other podcast. That's everybody. The Abe Greenwald's Motives podcast that we do.
Now that would be a fun one,
and I and I'm confused about my motives. I don't. I'm in between.
Well,
the two
we'll
of
tell you.
I don't know.
Yeah. You know them clearly. Yeah. I think he's. I don't think he's trying to lose more voters. I think he's trying to keep the ones he's got.
I don't think he's trying to lose more voters. I think he's trying to lash out. I think he wants something out of this scorched earth policy. It's not to lose.
Right.
It's some kind of revenge. And if losing is thrown into the bag, then so be it.
Well, I think what he's doing is going on instinct, working on what worked for him in the primaries and trying to keep that cohort of voters intact, which is his floor. Now, what is his floor? We don't really know what his floor is. We've all kind of seen iterations of it appear during really bad news cycles. He's bottomed out in the RCP average versus Hillary Clinton at 38%, but there's a variety of polls out there at states that show him going much lower than that, into the 34, 33, 32% range.
Now, remember, the problem with this, looking at those polls that show him at 32, is yet again, it doesn't show they don't show Hillary at 52. They don't show Hillary at 62. So the thing that is missing from these polls is either those voters who are withdrawing from him, but who look as though they are going to vote based on past patterns, will grudgingly come back to the GOP in the last days because they got nowhere else to go, will find a third party alternative, will throw in with Gary Johnson, or if they can, with Evan McMullen, if he's on the ballot somewhere, or they will stay home and the electorate will be much smaller than people realize. But it does not appear as though, as would be the case in a conventional election, the people that might nominally vote for him and that in the polling in September and October who seem to be on a seesaw say, yeah, you know what, I'm not going to vote for John McCain, I'm going to vote for Barack Obama. So in the last week, 4 or 5% shift over. People seem pretty determined not to launch Hillary up into the 50s, you know? I mean, that these polls with him in the low 30s still show her in the low 40s.
Right, so given that, we'll assume
when that adds up to like 76, 77%, right, which means we're effectively at 20 to 25% undecided, you know, we're now 3.5 weeks from the election. That is so unprecedented that we are, you know, there's no, I don't even know what the polling means.
Right. So this prediction is worth precisely the paper that it's printed on, but that means that they probably won't show up and the electorate will be small. And then Hillary Clinton ends up with 48, 49% and Trump ends up at 42, 43%. They all end up outperforming their averages.
Well, I mean, if the electorate gets small, which is the deepest hope of the Clinton campaign, is that we have a depressed Republican electorate. That is the key to winning the Senate and taking over the House. It is now more than thinkable that Democrats may take the House if Trump doesn't stabilize, if his numbers don't stabilize, if he doesn't get into the low 40s, and if he doesn't score in the low 40s. Remember, Republicans, the last time Republicans had numbers this bad, Bush in 92, but there were 19% of the electorate voted for Ross Perot, and 2/3 of them, or 70% of them, voted down ticket for Republicans of the Perot voters. So they were essentially Republican voters, manqué. And, you know, same thing a little bit happened in 96 when Perot got 9%. Effectively, all of those voters voted Republican and saved the Republican House for Republican House and Senate that had been won for Republicans. There is no such evident down ticket salvation. That was the point of the effort in the spring to recruit a serious third party challenger who would not win, but who would be a sort of stalking horse for down ballot Republicans to make sure that everything didn't crater. So the worst possibilities that were envisioned back in April and May are now coming true, and you know, we'll see where this goes.
Well, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because, and I'm going to cite 538 data here, because I just had a post that's on this, which is actually pretty enlightening, is that Hillary Clinton has been gaining in the polls, Donald Trump has been falling in the polls, but down ballot Democratic Senate candidates, for example, have not. They're pretty much stagnating. And in fact, we have a couple of polls that show the races tightening into being competitive races, including Pennsylvania, where Senator Toomey is up, and in Wisconsin, shockingly, where Ron Johnson has been left for dead. Two polls now have shown that race within 2 points. They're not putting any money into it on the right. The Club for Growth has already canceled ad buys over there, so they're not investing in it. But the suggestion that the idea, even if it's not promoted actively by Republicans, that the idea that Hillary Clinton's presidency is now baked in and a check on her in the form of divided government is important seems to have permeated the electorate a little bit.
Look, that point has to be made explicitly, and this is all very well and good to say this 26 days out, that, you know, Ayotte is tied in with Hassan in New Hampshire, and Toomey isn't dead, Toomey is sort of like either tied or a little up in Pennsylvania, and Johnson isn't dead in Wisconsin, if in the last week, if this drumbeat continues, and the only effect, the only purposeful effect of this, since I think a lot of us think that the presidency is now out of reach for Trump, the only effect of a relentless drumbeat is just going to make it so that it is a sickening prospect to have to go to the polls to vote. And maybe if Republicans make an all-out push on the argument that the presidency is lost, and if you don't want Hillary Clinton to enact a liberal agenda, that is a message that has to be explicitly made by Toomey, by Hassan, by Ayotte, by Johnson. It can't permeate, and they're still too afraid to peddle that message. Marco Rubio, this is a very significant thing. So Marco Rubio is sitting there having decided in Florida that it is too dangerous for him to unendorse Trump, right? Well, and he's running against a very unimpressive Democratic candidate. But if there is any place where the depression of the Republican vote will have a deleterious consequence, it's Rubio. If Rubio doesn't make an independent argument for his candidacy explicitly as an anti-Clinton argument, and maybe he's trying to do it and thread the needle, but you know, you have to be vulgar when you make your closing argument. You can't be.
I agree with you, and I think the bottom will probably fall out eventually, but it hasn't yet, and the indications are that Democrats, including President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, are nervous that it's not yet, because they're being very explicit about trying to tie the down ballot to Donald Trump now. President Barack Obama made the case that you have to unendorse a while back, and then he kind of let that slide. Yeah. Now he's making it again. Hillary Clinton is out there on the trail campaigning against down ballot Republicans by name. She didn't used to do that. They're starting to make the case that this is Trump writ large, this party.
But I mean, why wouldn't they at this point also? I mean, Trump has sort of freed them up to do that. I mean, he's sort of given them some sense of security regarding the White House.
This is where I'm going to make a too complicated by half claim, which is that they are nervous about making this argument, because the more they make this argument, the more that it could boomerang on them. If Hillary goes to Nevada and says, or Nevada, or however the hell it's pronounced, and says, you have to vote for Catherine Mastio?
Cortez
Mastio? Mastio-Cortez? Okay. You have to vote for her because Joe Heck, the senatorial candidate, Republican senatorial, is just a mini Trump. Then she is basically, she's not a popular candidate. She clearly is not a coattails candidate. There may be a negative coattails effect with Trump, but that's the sort of thing that could make Republicans say, well, I better go vote for Heck then, if they make too big a claim about this. That's why staying on the unendorsement thing is smart, because they're saying you have to say whether or not that throws them on the defensive. You have to say whether or not you're going to vote for Trump. That's you, senator candidate, you Republican, you know, House candidate, you have to say it. And then they go, well, I don't know what to do. I endorse, I unendorse, I re-endorse, I done-endorse. They look, you know, craven and foolish and stupid. But if they make an explicit, hey, let's win the Senate and the House for Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton is still like 56-57% unfavorable in the United States, that's the thing that could make people do what they don't want them to do. I don't know that for a fact. It seems too complicated by half, but, you know, we're in uncharted territory, so everything is uncharted. I note that, you know, Greg Sargent, who is basically the kind of Democratic mouthpiece blogger. No, but he's very useful, because he tells you he is a, you know, hour by hour temperature gauge of where conventional Democratic opinion is. He blogs for the Washington Post. Has been pushing for 2 or 3 days this notion that Hillary really has to go and start, you know, campaigning for Democrats down ballot. That may be a plea from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and the congressional campaign committees to come out because of what Noah is saying. But, you know, clearly there are risks involved.
Well, I'm curious if everybody agrees with me, but I think there are probably bigger risks if Hillary Clinton wins the Senate, or rather wins the presidency, having failed to make a really strong case for Democratic down ballot candidates. and they come up short, or they have a 50-50 tie, and they have to rely on Tim Kaine, who, by the way, is going to be replaced next year in a special election in Virginia that'll probably decide control of the Senate, or may possibly decide control of the Senate, because it doesn't look like it's going to be a washout just yet. So Democrats are really nervous with Hillary Clinton, and if she fails to deliver them, they already don't like her. Democrats don't have a lot of, you know, soft spot in their heart for Hillary Clinton. She's going to get into this presidency being the one of the most unloved figures ever to occupy that office. The honeymoon will be extremely short, and she's going to have to shore up her Democratic support.
Look, the
partisan
parallels,
support.
The parallels in a Hillary presidency to the first George H.W. Bush presidency are eerily close. That is to say, she comes in, she basically comes in as the third term of the sitting president. The Democratic Party has used up its A talent over 8 years with the Obama presidency. She is going to have she's going to have much less talent to choose from at the upper levels and in the strategic places. And people, a lot of people who might want to take these jobs are sick and tired of working in the, you know, either in the Congress or in the White House, and will want to go cash out and get, you know, serious high paying jobs places. And she will come in without a mandate. I mean, that is one of the things about the way that she has run this campaign is, I don't care what anybody says, and I don't care, you know, how liberal she is and how she's going to, this is the end of America as we know it. She has made no case for running, you know, a hard leftist presidency, which is what Republicans fear and what, you know, the Democratic base that voted for Sanders wants. And she may not, you know, unless the cataclysm happens and she wins the House, she's not going to have much in a way of being able to, you know, to create this leftist agenda. And Bush was saved by war. I mean, he wasn't even saved, but Bush had two wars, right? And he had Panama, and then he had the Gulf War, and the Gulf War was a triumph. He got to 91%. But this is the other thing to remember. When you come into office like this and you are an, you know, unimaginative and not particularly impressive political figure without much, you know, oomph, he got to 91% in the polls in March of 1991 and got 38% of the vote in 1992, which was 17% lower than he had received in 1988. Hillary comes in with a great many disadvantages, assuming she wins. But of course, she'll win. And so winning in that sense, all she wants, this is like a classic situation, all she wants, her focus, everything in her life has been about just getting there. And then once she gets there, so she'll try to do comparable worth, and she'll try to do some kind of paid national paid maternity leave. And, you know, Bush did this stuff too. Little bits and pieces and cutesy little, you know, right-wing legislation to make everybody happy.
This reminds me of a column that Ross Douthat wrote a few months ago now, saying that perhaps a lackluster, mandate-free Hillary Clinton presidency is sort of just the thing that the country actually needs at the moment. In other words, to sort of remind us that politics is a sort of disappointing, dirty business where miracles are not granted, right, and sort of calm us and sort of bring our insane political culture back down to earth.
Right, in some kind of Burkean, you know, frame, yeah, where he says, you know, George W. Bush attempted to be a transformational president. Barack Obama has sought to be a transformational president. What we need is an anti-transformational president. That said, the public isn't going to be that happy with an anti-transformational president. And, you know, the thing that I find so dispiriting in prospect is, so what's the first thing that's going to happen in a Hillary Clinton presidency? A Supreme Court nomination. Right, so assume she drops Merrick Garland, which she ought to, because she really ought to, her first major decision ought to be her own, which is why I couldn't believe that Garland agreed to be the candidate in the first place. because he was never going to get in during the Obama presidency. And, you know, now there's this whole notion of, well, you know, in the lame duck term, the, you know, Republican Senate should confirm Merrick Garland because he's the best you're going to do. But they're not going to do that. And they should, but they won't, let's say. And so she will then, you know, find some classic fit all the possible, you know, and then that happens. And then we get another one of these fights over a Supreme Court nomination and digging up people's, you know, college papers and article that they wrote for the school paper in 1973. And, you know, their kid got a DUI and they're going to have hearings and they're not going to answer any questions. And people are going to say they should answer their questions. And Hillary's going to say, yes, I used a litmus test because I want pro-choice. And then they're going to say, oh, she's using a litmus test. Republicans weren't allowed to use a litmus test. Remember in 1991, all the talk about how it would be evil to have a litmus test. And now you have a litmus test. And we're going to yet again be in this kind of, it's like no exit. You know, it's like Sartre's vision of hell. You know, you just, or the eternal return, you know, Nietzsche's eternal return or Goethe's eternal return. It's just like, everything that happened before is going to happen again and again and again and again. Confirmation fights and, you know, and bad legislation. Republicans will block and then clever Democratic efforts to poison Republican legislation. Republican efforts to poison Democratic legislation. And the end result will be that not much will get done, which is, I think, in the end, a good point of doubt. You know, will satisfy Douthat's wishes and will sicken the American people still further about our political system.
Well, that presupposes that we're in a normal political environment, which I'm inclined to agree with. But there is, as you noted briefly, that there is sort of an apocalyptic sentiment on the right, which I in part think has to do with, you know, we all have to justify ourselves why we're voting for somebody who doesn't know what nuclear weapons do. But that doesn't mean it's not a real sentiment. And the idea that Republicans are just going to rally around, you know, the flag and jump in the foxhole to oppose Hillary Clinton, again, something I'm inclined to agree with, and then just, you know, saunter into a pretty good cycle in 2018 just based on the map, you know, it kind of assumes that 2016 never happened. And as we talked about a couple of podcasts ago, I do think that Republicans need to really reconcile with what happened here and have a real open and honest conversation about the transformations that need to occur in order to make sure this doesn't happen again.
But it's not just that. They may delude themselves. I don't know who they are because I haven't had these conversations with anybody. But 2018 will be a great map for the House and Senate again. That doesn't mean that every single, you know, serious Republican isn't going to have some psycho, you know, primary challenge that has unexpected power.
Well, they might power. If they refuse
to address
this.
And there is, let us remember, there is Trump Inc., which is going to exist after the election, which is going to have this giant mailing list and this giant digital presence and the Ben Carson thing also and all this and all sorts of ways for people to rent, you know, Trump will, you know, rent out his, you know, bathroom if he can get $12 out of it. So you know that he's going to try to make money off of what they built, you know, over the course of this year, however ineffectual it's been in garnering, you know. And there you could really have people getting knocked off all over the place as long as the candidates aren't totally insane, like Paul Nealon, the guy who, you know, ran against Paul Ryan.
But every minute you could have
10, you could have 15 Dave Bratts knocking off, you know, perfectly creditable, you know, what if, you know, you have Dave Bratt knocks off Cory Gardner in Colorado, you know, who will be deemed insufficiently hardline or something like that, you know. So that's the problem is not that, you know, the party has to have an intellectual reckoning. The problem is that the destructive id forces that have manifested themselves in Trump might atomize and become 435 little Trumps or, you know, or 33 Trumps at the Senate level.
I don't think you can make the distinction between what Donald Trump is and what his people who've tried to emulate him have done. And Dave Bratt wasn't, I mean, he's definitely Trump popular, but he's an electable guy. He's an intellectual. He was a writer and somebody who's been in politics for a long time. All the mini Trumps that we've seen come and go have been, you know, really aggressive populist, anti-immigration, right talk radio types, and they're not really Dave Brett. I mean, I'm not a huge fan.
No, but
fan,
remember
but
the whole point about Dave Brett. Yeah, but the whole point about Dave Brett is that he ran against somebody and no one paid any attention. It was a low turnout primary, and he knocked Eric Cantor, who was the House Majority Leader, you know, in a primary. And primarying people is what has been the story of, you know, I mean, it's effectively, you know, Cruz, didn't primary a sitting, Ted Cruz didn't primary a sitting senator, right? He primaried the choice of the Texas GOP, David Dewhurst, and knocked him off. And Marco Rubio, again, not a sitting senator, but was the sitting governor, and he knocked him off by running an insurgent campaign against him. So there is precedent, pre-Trump precedent, for this as a successful, you know. I'm just saying, we don't know what's going to happen, but where you're right is that the interesting centripetal force, or I think that's the one I mean, would be in Washington for there to be a full-on, if Hillary Clinton didn't have the Sandersites, she could make a full-on press on Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to make grand bargains so that she could prove herself as a leader who can get things done, you know, some stuff on entitlements, some stuff, so she gets this and they get that, and the Republican base, you know, screams. But in the end, you know, they will have legislative accomplishments to show for it. Paul Ryan can say that he saved saved Medicare, which is going to go broke in 2028. You know, stuff like that. She can't because she's not strong enough with her own base, and they can't because the revolutionary Republican right will not allow them to. And so that is the recipe for, you know, perpetual gridlock. There's one interesting aspect of this that occurred to me the other day, which is in 2009, you know, it's been a talking point of Democrats that Republicans said, we're not going to cast a single vote for, you know, Obama. He's not going to get anything through with Republican votes. The hell with him. They're not going to get a thing from us. They had the luxury of doing that in this one sense, which is, of course, that once Al Franken got into the Senate in after a six-month recount in 2009, they had a veto-proof, they had a cloture. Democrats had could work their will in the Senate, and they had the majority in the House. And so the whole point of the Republicans saying, we are not going to vote, we're not going to cast a single vote for Obama, was we are not going to give you cover to say that what you're doing is bipartisan. We're not. You can pass everything because you have control. We are not going to provide you with the notion that the American people are going along with your agenda. Our people don't, and we're not going to do that. And that was fine. Like, so Obama used it. People say, oh, the Republicans, they were so obstructionist. They weren't obstructionist at all. There was no obstruction for them. The only people who were obstructing Obamacare in 2009, 2010 were Democrats, with Joe Lieberman, who basically said, I'm not going to vote for this, and then you won't make cloture if you put a public option into Obamacare. And so they didn't. I mean, you know, leftist Democrats might think that Joe Lieberman is a Republican, but Joe Lieberman was a Democrat, at least at the time. So, Republicans had that. Now they will not have that. That's the interesting thing. They don't play with her. She doesn't play with them. Like, there is, you know, it really is like 2011 through 2016. Like, she can't get a thing through. They can't get a thing through. And the public is going to be very uncomfortable with this, it seems to me. Like, it's one thing if it's Obama. Obama, you know, passed $3 trillion practically of new spending in 16 months. And so everybody could like rear and horror and say, no, we don't know what Hillary wants to do. Now, granted, she's Hillary and Republicans hate her and Democrats don't like her and all that. But, you know, just the notion that this goes on forever where no one can cross the aisle to vote for anybody else's policy, that was not envisioned in the makeup of our government. It's supposed to be hard to pass legislation. It was supposed to be difficult to make changes. Not impossible. So that's the end of my rant there.
I don't have anything to disagree with there. And it's probably a little frustrating. I would imagine that she has made some promises that she's going to have to try to make good on. The one that sticks out in my mind is her pledge in the first 100 days to pursue immigration reform with an eye towards citizenship with no border security. Now, I think that she could really put Republicans in a very bad position, particularly given the context of 2016, if she were to pursue a very liberal reform and then back off a little bit and give Republicans a buy-in in the form of border security. And we're presuming that the Senate falls, so she's got just basically the House as a bulwark, a truncated Republican majority in the House to oppose this sort of thing. And they can claim, I mean, I know you've said there's no mandate there for Hillary Clinton, but they can sure claim that Republicans of the anti-immigration reform sort had a mandate, had a referendum on their view and lost it. And that's where you need to
look. If they win the Senate, they're going to have 51 seats in the Senate. She can't get immigration reform through the Senate. How does she get immigration reform through the Senate? She needs 60 votes to close debate in the Senate. So
you give them Republicans a buy-in in the form of legalization, not citizenship, border security.
Right, but that's what I'm talking about. That is what you would think would happen in a normal political context after a normal political season, right? But it isn't a normal season. Her temptation will be to go as far left on this as possible, to be in perpetual campaign trolling. Obama can't get anything through, so he just issues, you know, proposals that, you know, are either nakedly unconstitutional that he knows eventually a court is going to overturn, or doesn't even try to get legislation through. She's got to do things. I mean, it's the same thing with the Supreme Court judges. Like, if she doesn't get the Senate majority, she's not going to get the judge that she wants. So then she has this interesting choice, which is, does she pick somebody that gives everybody on the left a, you know, thrill up their leg and lose it so that she can have a sacrificial lamb, which is essentially sort of like, you know, or does she try to find somebody that Republicans can at least vote for and allow to go through? The Democratic temptation, the constant partisan temptation in this country is to say, I want to prove that those guys are horrible and they can't be trusted. That's already going to have happened. Like, it's not going to be it's not going to get any worse than Trump. It's not going to, well, what they've
famous
said
about, last words.
No, what I mean is they've said everything that they can possibly say about Republicans, and Trump has proved them right in his person. So the notion that they're going to say, can you believe that they're not going to allow me to, you know, appoint this, you know, Akhil Amar to the Supreme Court? Like, Akhil Amar, like, what? So? Like, that, I mean, that's nothing. I mean, that's, you know, then they'll make some kind of an art. It's, I don't know. I'm now getting
totally... Well, that immigration issue is a little different. I mean, what did they benefit from more, keeping the issue alive and keeping Republicans at war over it, or neutralizing it essentially on their terms with the most minimal amount of buy-in? I mean, they can claim a mandate on one piece of legislation.
You think that with appropriate buy-ins here and there, she could get 9 Republican votes for an immigration reform package?
Well, we don't know what the makeup of the next Senate is going to be.
Well, I know. That's still...
Nine's a lot.
That's a pretty
big
buy-in.
But 6 isn't.
Well, 6 isn't. That would be if it's 6, that's, you know, that's Reagan in 80. That's an 11. Yeah, that's an 11 seat Senate shift that gets them where they only need 6 Republicans. I think it's 11.
I'm thinking of 6 vulnerable Republicans who I could see.
But this also depends on the Republican mindset after the election. I mean, you know, which have they firmly decided that they're done with Trumpism?
I think Republicans would want to get immigration right off the table. Looking at what it's done to them.
Who?
Right.
Which Republicans?
Those who will inherit
Jeff Sessions is still in the Senate. Jeff Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Davis, Gone with the Wind Sessions is still going to be the leading Republican voice on immigration in the Senate, and he's not going anywhere. And he's going to stand around saying, "You betrayed, you're betraying, you're betraying, you're betraying, you're taking our country away, you're betraying." And then the direct mail machine starts, and the and the entertainment wing, the talk show hosts, go take this up and go completely nuts and start stirring up the base. And it goes like that. Like, I can think of many issues that it would be horrendous for Republicans to have as the leading one coming up. And but also for Hillary, because it just means her first big effort will be a failure. I mean, that's, let's just game this out a little bit. She wins the presidency. She wins, she might even win a giant electoral landslide, you know, 400 electoral votes or something like that. Though maybe less than 50% of the vote. So she wins this giant electoral landslide. She's got to get it. She's got to get a Supreme Court justice through, and she's got to have a governing agenda for the first year. So is she going to want to lose everything that she puts up? I mean, she'll think, they'll say, oh, look, you can do whatever you want, but she's not going to be able to. But the Republicans are, there will be no after November 8th disincentive for sitting Republicans to suddenly find compromise in their hearts. That, I mean, where, what are the, what's the incentive package that has them do that?
Well, in particular on immigration, and I can only think of immigration on this when I try to think of them being in a box, is that the idea of taking this thing off the table, even in terms that are slightly unfavorable, really early in 2017, allows you a lot of time to let the steam clear off. And then the issue is off the table. Look, think of how gay marriage was gamed out.
You think it's unfavorable, and I think it's unfavorable, and Abe thinks it's unfavorable. And Jefferson Davis Sessions does not think that being hawkish on immigration is a bad play for him or for his people.
But they won a plurality of the primary vote, and they're not going to be a majority of the conference in the next Congress. The Republicans are going to look on a 400 electoral vote landslide, majority loss, and then say, we ought to do exactly the same thing we did in 2016, even if it's a suicide pact? I don't think so.
No, but they could say, we need to harness some of what happened in 2016 and repackage it in a more articulate form and you know still fight for those causes that's such a representative
more articulately.
But that's who they are.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No. That's not what I'm recommending.
That's who a lot of these. That's who a lot of these people are. Look, the way you have to look at this is not legislatively about what the party's future is in this one sense. The question is after November 8th. Assuming a large Trump loss or even a moderate Trump loss. So what happens not in the Senate and the House, but in the Republican National Committee? Okay, so Reince Priebus is sitting there. Reince Priebus threw in all of his chips on Trump. He's there. He's sitting there. He's got to resign and go, right? Because that's the first thing. Like, he presided over the, you know, terrible situation. He's got to go. Except the party doesn't decide. 168 Republican committee members decide, members of the Republican National Committee. The obvious thing for Republicans to do now is to mimic the Democrats and create a superdelegate system, right? Which is what the Democrats did in 1984 to stop Jesse Jackson. So you create so that there is a firebreak against a kind of, you know, takeover of the party by, you know, sort of hostile takeover of the party from the outside. Are the committee men going to agree to this? It disempowers them. It makes, by the way, it makes the Republican National Committee a lot larger, among other things. I mean, because you can't just have 168 delegates apportioning 20 committee members apportioning 2,500 delegates. You need a sort of larger system. Yes. They'll have to disempower themselves. And are they going to think that this was a catastrophe? I mean, they should. But we don't know who they are anymore.
Yeah, and it's a very hard thing to do, also given the atmosphere. It invites charges. Look, see, I told you the establishment is scared.
The establishment stealing. They're going to steal. You see, everything that Trump said is true.
Right. They almost got him. Now look at them.
And
yeah.
Look at, and what, by the way, what an amazing thing Trump accomplished. That's, we all think the classic thing is somebody loses and everybody hates a loser, right? So everybody dumps on Romney and everybody dumps on McCain. It's so awful and it's so terrible. And you dump on the loser Dukakis and Carter and Mondale, and they're all such losers and Dole and everything is terrible. Okay, so there's going to be this whole crew of people who are going to say, look, he came out of nowhere. He just came down an escalator. He got 53 million votes. Whoever did that before, you think these people, don't mock these people. They're more powerful than you. Every one of them wants the changes that Donald Trump wanted affected. That hasn't changed. Now, I don't believe that to be true. And I think it's a preposterous argument. But I don't know that elected officials and party officials aren't going to be scared out of their wits the same way on November 9th that they were on, you know, that they were on Monday after the debate when he did okay. So Deb Fischer re-endorsed after unendorsing the senator from Nebraska, you know.
Well, it probably will be. I mean, just assuming that there's no spine in any of these people is never a bad bet.
Do we have any evidence that there is a spine in the Republican Party?
No, like I said, it's not a bad bet. But at the same time, the argument can't be totally enumerate. I mean, if you're talking about a 7-point loss and the associated wave victory, which will take at least one chamber and possibly two with it, I mean, you reform after that. There's very few precedents to suggest that people stay the course.
Yeah, but reforming can be reform in the Trump direction.
Right.
You're assuming that reform is reform in the, okay, let's all get sane so this doesn't happen again direction. They're going
to
be...
Well, that would only make sense. I mean, to look at the loss behind Donald Trump and say we need to double down on Donald Trump.
Are we not in a post-factual environment?
I mean,
we're sitting in an environment in which the candidate for president of the United States says he didn't say something he said 5 minutes earlier, over and over again.
Right, and the idea that Republicans are going to want to sign on to that Sisyphean torture for eternity is insane. I can't imagine that.
Look, okay, George McGovern lost the presidency in 1972. He got 37% of the vote, and McGovernites took the party over. I mean, it was not that the Democratic Party was a McGovernite party from 1972 until 1992. And remember the whole thing with Goldwater. Goldwater lost in 64, but he created the conditions under which the conservative wave could happen by 1980. I don't think that's true. I don't believe that argument, but it's certainly not true structurally. But the idea that the McGovern people became the Democratic Party is unassailably true. And so in defeat, they didn't lose the House and Senate.
It is the third consecutive defeat, which historically suggests a little different behavior.
We're having an argument. We don't know your case is totally credible.
You're right.
Your case is completely credible. And I think my case is emotionally credible. Which isn't to say I believe that it's going to happen. I'm saying, you know, you can't simply presume that the fever is going to break. There's no reason to think the fever is going to break. I mean, if he gets 35% of the vote, the fever breaks. If he gets 34% of the vote, the fever breaks. If he gets 41% of the vote, suddenly, hey, he got more votes than Bob Dole did. Bob Dole, very cool. He was a great man. Who doesn't love Bob Dole? I'm just saying, like, the ability to prosecute an argument based on no evidence whatsoever has been a prevailing feature of this year on the right and in the Republican Party. I mean, what happened? What's happened here? What did we say? What did we hear in March or April or something like that? Various people heard the Democrats have got 10, 12, 15, 20 women under lock and key. They got them deposed. They've got them and they're holding them in abeyance until October, and then they're going to drop them on Trump's head. Okay. I am not, despite what everybody might think, a big Republican insider. I don't commune with forces in the party and have deep background conversations. This is just kind of like water cooler talk, but it was not only there, but in journalistic circles, right? We knew this was going to happen. Everybody knew this was going to happen. Everybody knew this was going to happen, and nobody ran third party. Everybody knew this was going to happen, And nobody allowed the, you know, like the effort to wrest the nomination on the floor from Trump, because at every moment you could only deal with the thing that was right ahead of you, which was, if I do this, then obviously there will be this reaction and I can't stand that reaction. So I'm going to go on entropically, right? Second law of thermodynamics. So just a body in motion will stay in motion. So no one wanted to arrest the body in motion because the consequences, the early consequences were too, you know, definable and easy to see. Okay, but you knew in October that there was going to be a nuclear holocaust, and yet, you know, you were like, "Well, I can't do this in July; it's too dangerous." So, you know, as the prince says at the end of Romeo and Juliet, "All are punished." You know, the Republican Party is going to be punished; it may lose the House and Senate, and the nation is going to be punished because this crook, liar, you know, and. Is gonna, you know, is gonna end up this crook, liar, unpopular person who endangered national security is gonna end up being president of the United States.
I think we can all get to work on impeachment proceedings pretty quickly.
well, cheer. I don't know who's going to appoint the special prosecutor. That was apparently the great error in the other debate, was the notion that a special prosecutor would be appointed to deal with that matter. But speaking of which, if we have a little time, there is this matter in the press of WikiLeaks and all the material coming out from the hacked emails of John Podesta, the campaign chairman, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. We are here astonishingly uneasy with the notion of even talking about this because it's a Russian intelligence operation. This is stolen property. Personal stolen property, not a government document that's leaked. It's a man's personal stolen property. He's a private citizen. It's nobody's business. It's really horrifying. And yet, obviously, this material now public is going to be part of the public record. It's going to be used by every journalist and writer who is going to try to fashion a portrait of the Clinton campaign. Noah, what are your impressions in general of what the WikiLeaks documents are telling us?
Well, and there's been some notion that they're kind of uninteresting and unimportant, and something to be dismissed. And I don't necessarily think
that's
true.
Well, that's all liberal. That's a liberal fantasy that therefore they don't have to pay attention to them because there's no smoking gun that says, you know, Hillary, you know, killed a guy, you know, on her lawn.
Another along those lines, and it's a brief digression, is Jen Palmieri came out yesterday and said, you know, this is...
She's
a campaign communications operative on the Hillary Clinton campaign. She used to be a White House deputy communications director, and now she's on Hillary Clinton's campaign. Anyway, she came out and she said that this is a Russian intelligence operation, as you just said, which is the assessment of the FBI and the intelligence community. And as such, you shouldn't be talking about them. Now, that's kind of a huge ask. We're talking about, you know, human nature here is to assess these things as we receive them. It's like introducing evidence as a prosecutor and then having a jury strike it from the record. And it's never going to be struck. It's there. At the same time, however, it is worth noting that I think Republicans conflate the attack on the DNC and the DSC and the DCCC and the stolen documents that were laundered through WikiLeaks by Russian military intelligence. And they misconstrue that as being part of Hillary Clinton's server scandal because people aren't really making the distinction.
Right.
These are two different things. The Democratic committees are private organizations that were attacked by a foreign power, according to the FBI and the intelligence community. That we haven't seen any information leaked from Hillary Clinton's private server through these foreign intelligence organizations. While what she did was probably illegal in a lot of people's estimation, if not the FBI's, and certainly untoward and certainly a violation of ethics agreements, they are not the subject of a foreign attack. And I think conservatives are conflating those two things because their media just isn't telling them. Now, that being said, these leaked documents, some of them were very interesting, and particularly we're going to talk about this attack on the Catholic Church. Which I think it deserves to be addressed, but it's also something you can argue about. But what shouldn't be argued about is the fact that apparently Donna Brazile, who's now the head of the DNC after Debbie Wasserman Schultz was ousted, got questions that were identical to those that were posed to Hillary Clinton in a CNN town hall during the primaries, suggesting that there was collusion between media and Hillary Clinton's campaign, which should be a humongous bombshell. And it's really not.
Okay, here's why I think that the Donna Brazile thing is fascinating and well worth, and CNN should be embarrassed beyond belief, but does not quite tell that story. So CNN hires Donna Brazile. That does not make Donna Brazile a journalist. That does not make, it's sort of like Corey Lewandowski. These guys, they are not journalists. They are hired to be partisan spokesmen on television. This is a new thing. This is something pretty much that Jeff Zucker of CNN has inaugurated. You know, you have Paul Begala, who was simultaneously, although, you know, Karl Rove did this too on Fox. I mean, Paul Begala is simultaneously running a super PAC for Hillary and is a spokes, you know, talks like a, you know, sitting next to Gloria Borger, who's a journalist, and various other journalists. And Donna Brazile and Corey Lewandowski are sitting there, both of whom are partisan, effectively spokesmen for the campaign that they are, that CNN is paying because they're not on the inside. So Donna Brazile's loyalty is not to CNN. Donna Brazile's not loyalty isn't to making sure that the debate is fresh and fair between, she is trying to get Hillary Clinton elected. And so if she gets her hands on the debate questions, of course she's going to try to send them off to the, does one think that then the debate questions were handed to her literally to send them off to the Clinton campaign so the Clinton campaign will be prepared? I doubt it. I just think basically that these questions were circulated around to see what, you know, whether anybody had. And remember, the other thing was that this debate was on TV1, which is an African-American majority network, with CNN. This was a TV1 CNN debate. So the idea that they would go to Donna Brazile and to Roland Martin, their two leading African-American political commentators, say, do you think these questions are good? Are they really, is this the kind of question we should be asking? You know, makes perfect sense. It would be like if I were at Fox and, you know, they were having a debate with the American Jewish Committee and they wanted to know if these questions were sufficiently sensitive to the concerns of the Jewish community. But Donna Brazile did it, and she clearly did it, and then she said WikiLeaks did it, and you're all being mean to me, and I'm a victim of Russian intelligence. Of all the things that she is not, she's a victim of Russian intelligence. So yeah, it came out, so it's incredibly embarrassing. Like, she's not the victim of Russian intelligence. John Podesta is the victim of Russian intelligence. This was all something that they found out because his stuff was stolen, not hers. And so I just think that, you know, it's incredibly embarrassing, but it's not a story about journalistic collusion, I don't think. What it is a story about is the horrendous total slide, the notion that, you know, you pay everybody for everything so you can lock them down. And so Donna Brazile, who's working for Hillary Clinton, should be paid by a news network.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, maybe the story isn't about Donna Brazile following her loyalties, but it is about this larger network of mixing political actors with commentators and the way this has now come about. I mean, right. That's...
Well, how else would you get people on television if you didn't have a contributor contract?
People go on television. This is the story of television. You say to somebody, drive 2.5 hours to be on for 3 minutes, and they do it. That's why.
Yeah.
But you don't get them locked down.
Yeah.
No, it's what you say. You know, they know pretty well. They're just trying to lock people down.
But by the way, I also had an awful thought to link this back to what we were talking about before about Hillary presidency. To what extent do we fear that email hacks are now sort of part of our political reality after the election? I mean, add that to what if they come up during what if when there's a Supreme Court nominee? There are now hacks, especially if the hackers have it in for Hillary.
And that's the real fear, is that while we haven't seen any of Hillary Clinton's personal correspondence, there's very little doubt that they're out there. She would behave very poorly when it came to InfoSec, when she was out in places like Vietnam using her mobile device, which linked to her email account, which was undoubtedly penetrated, and the result is that they have this information. Now, the likelihood is that Donald Trump is a lost cause. So the Russians have whatever they have, the Chinese have whatever they have, and they're going to keep it and use it at their when they need it most. So I'm less afraid of the stuff that we see in public, and I'm much more afraid of the stuff that has been compromised that we'll never see.
What is all this about anyway? What is national security and the maintenance of security about? It's about blackmail. It's about the prevention of putting, it's about the fact that people, sources and methods of people who are, you know, cooperating with you are exposed, and people may die. And then it's also the question of whether or not things that they find out about you can be used against you for blackmail purposes. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to imagine the president of the United States personally getting blackmailed, but, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. And it's not beyond the bounds of a Clinton to be the sort of person who would somehow figure that the cost-benefit analysis of that would be to pay the blackmail rather than say, yes, I did this, yes, this happened. You know, I cannot in good conscience allow the, you know, allow Vladimir Putin to control our foreign policy because I in a weak moment did X, Y, or Z. I mean, that would be hard on anybody, but that's what we're talking about. Of course, what you're talking about, Abe, is the nightmare come true. It's already happened. Like you said before we started the podcast, that everything that we are talking about now, these are all not facts. Everything we're talking about are stolen documents and allegations. And allegations are now issued as though they were truth. I believe in the credibility of these accusations against Donald Trump, but you know, 15 years ago they wouldn't necessarily have come out because there was no corroborating evidence. Right. I mean, the New York Times fought to get corroborating evidence on the two women who were in the story. Like they talked to a couple of other people who said, yes, contemporaneously I was told about this, which is basically all you can do. Now, if the Trump campaign, the joke, the hilarity of the Trump campaign or the Trumpkins or whoever they are, after the story came out, saying things like, well, he couldn't have groped that woman on a plane because they were in for A, he wasn't on the plane because he had his own plane. The story was in 1984 when he may not have had his own plane. People had their own planes a lot less then. B, they were in first class, so the armrests couldn't move, which, if I remember correctly, not that I was in first class much between Los Angeles and New York, but if I remember correctly, the armrests moved, and the first class was a lot less nice than it is now, and they didn't have these, like, you know, you weren't sitting in these giant cargo buckets with 10,000 entertainment devices in the armrests. And but, I mean, that's if they knew that he wasn't on a plane in 1984, they could have said to the New York Times, what's the date that she alleges he was on the plane, right? I mean, a normal exchange would be New York Times goes to Trump for comment, and they say, she says in 1984 you groped her on a plane. He would say, what's the date on which she claims I was on that plane? What was the date?
Right.
Because if you don't have a date, I can't then go back into my book and tell you where I was on, you know, June 16th, 1984. Okay? You need to find that date and then tell me what it is, and then we'll go to United Airlines and see if I was on the manifest. And if I'm not on the manifest, you're committing libel and slander, and the story is not true. But
it's funny, as we're saying this, I'm getting a dispatch that Rush Limbaugh is right now discussing seat dividers in first-class flights, disputing Trump victims' accounts.
Okay, but we don't even know what airline it was.
No, we don't. Okay. But we don't know if, and by the way, Donald Trump said that. I mean, the only thing that NY Times printed was a threat to sue.
So if he didn't come up through, across, under the armrest, he came over the armrest and groped her. So, but I'm just saying there are ways in which a normal person faced with an unsubstantiated allegation could suppress the story by forcing the reporter to, I mean, I'm just saying, like, I know what you say, what was the date, what was the flight, I will prove to you I was not on that flight. He didn't do that. The fact that he didn't do that suggests that he did it.
Right.
I mean, that's the easiest thing. He just said, you're disgusting, and hung the phone up.
He did what Jen Palmieri did, which is to say, I'm going to sue you. This is nonsense. You need to suppress this information. Palmieri says, this is Russian information, intelligence information. You're assisting in a foreign intelligence operation undermining our democracy. You need to shut up about this. These are two sides of the same coin.
Right. Now, but except, here's the story with Jennifer Palmieri. The joke about this is that, so she was caught in one of these email exchanges saying something in response to an extremely unflattering thing that was said about Rupert Murdoch baptizing his children in the Catholic Church because he wants them to be taught regressive gender stereotypes. And then she said something like, what? She said something like, well, you know, he would probably wanted to go evangelical, but that would be a step too far even for him with his friends, right? So this is some guy who isn't even on the Clinton campaign, who works for the Center for American Progress, sends some stupid email to Jennifer Palmieri, and they have like a little back and forth about it, in which they both reveal themselves to be standard issue ignoramuses, you know, loathsome, you know, loathers of people who are people of faith and who they think they can just, you know, brush off with that classic leftist sanctimony. But it's got nothing to do with the election whatsoever. It's a glimpse into a mindset that, I don't know, I'm happy to see it because it confirms my biases against them. But Hillary Clinton is nowhere in that exchange.
Well, Podesta's barely in it. I mean,
Podesta's not in it. It's like the whole thing with Bill. Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, I do believe that there is an issue to be raised about Hillary Clinton's role in discrediting women who have charged her husband with, you know, with sexual attack. And I do believe that that's true. But citing their trying to prove that the attacks were real or that they were credible witnesses or something like that nonetheless gets at the fact that she was not the one who did it. I mean, I can't even believe I'm sitting here defending this, but I mean, you know, this is how crazy things are. He brings those women to the debate. You know, Juanita Broderick and Kathleen Willey, he said Paula Jones was there, but I didn't see Paula Jones there. And then this, and you know, and the 12-year-old that she, as a public defender, she tried to, you know, create ambiguity about the case of the 12-year-old who accused someone of rape. But I mean, that's sort of about her. That was 42 years ago, and she was a public defender, obliged under her legal responsibilities to provide the best defense to her client. Bill Clinton is not running for president. He's disgusting. The world knows he's disgusting. There were two elections. There was an election. People knew about Jennifer Flowers in 1992. If people said they didn't believe it was true, they just didn't want to believe it was true. Of course it was true. And then Paula Jones, and she then won elections in New York, and she won elections, and you know, now she's going to become president of the United States. The notion that people don't know that this happened is ridiculous. And what's more, it's one of the reasons that she's unpopular. It's like Trump. It's like the notion, oh, well, you know, we really need to litigate this thing with Bill Clinton so that people will know the truth about Hillary Clinton. Like, she's a very unpopular person because a lot of people know that she enabled him and that she staged attacks on Monica Lewinsky and people like that. So, you know, what more do you want? You know, it's like, it's like that thing that, Rubio did in the debate in some sense. That destroyed him. You know, when he said,
"Let's dispel
with the notion that Obama doesn't know what he's doing. Knows exactly what he's doing." And then Christie said something, and he was like, "No, you're not listening to me. I said Obama knows exactly what he's doing." Christie said, "You're repeating yourself." And he's like, "No, you're not listening to me. He knows what he's doing." And then Christie said, "Okay, you did it again." The whole world laughed, and Marco Rubio was finished as a presidential candidate. This is like the right over 20 years. He's a rapist. He's a okay. I heard you already. You know, I've. No, you're not listening to me. There have only been 5,000 books and 22,000 articles, and you know, 10 million books have been sold alleging the evils of Bill Clinton's behavior. Like, he's the most litigated person in American history.
And this is why
he was impeached over sexual misconduct.
And that's why, bringing this back around to earlier conversation, he's running the campaign that Breitbart and Talk Radio have always wanted to see, the campaign that's really hard on Bill Clinton's past against Hillary Clinton. Just, you know, a primal scream of rage in Hillary Clinton's face. It's not about winning, it's about catharsis. And that'll lose, right? And they're not going to correct for that. We're not going to look around and say, okay, that we finally ran this campaign that you guys have been saying we should run for the last 20 years, and it crashed and burned, and we're not going to do anything about this?
But they're not going to – Bill Clinton's not going to be the content of a Trumpian reformation after the election. It's not going to be about Bill Clinton.
It's just indicative of a broader –
Yeah, approach. No, look, I take your point. That is how things would be if things are rational. However, what they'll say, whether anybody listens to them is a different question, is that it was Commentary Magazine and the Weekly Standard and National Review who suppressed the truth, and the Never Trumpers who had such power that they, you know, that they got one guy in Utah to run for president
of Utah.
For president of Utah. He may win president of Utah. It's very exciting. for him. He seems like a great guy, and his vice president seems like a lovely, you know, like a lovely woman, and everything's really terrific there. But, you know, the power, the awesome power, you know, is against Limbaugh, Hannity, Fox, you know, InfoWars, Breitbart, you know, which has supposedly has something like, I don't know, had 170 million page views last month, you know, and then there's like, you know, basically a couple of Jews davening in the corner, and they're the ones who are going to be responsible for the world not knowing the truth about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, you know, running a rape gang, basically. So, you know, maybe we will have the clarifying, bracing moment of sanity that will finally, in which, you know, someone can basically say, okay, enough. Okay, you had your fun, now go back into your hole. But by the way, that's not even that is going to be acceptable, because like as Ross Douthat and others say, well, we have to do something about the voters. What about the vote? What about their concerns?
Oh, you should.
What about their voting concerns?
You should.
Of course you should. Of course you should. But there you get into more substantive issues. Like, right. Okay, so they're all so how much of the passion there is opposed to free trade? There is no way to square the circle between a free trade party and an anti-free trade party. There just isn't. So one or the other force has got to win that argument and control the discussion. That you can't have both. The Democratic Party proved this. You could not be a pro-life and a pro-choice party at the same time. They tried in the 1980s to have the urban Democrats be pro-life and everybody else be pro-choice, and by the mid-90s, that was gone. So you can't have two faces. There are issues on which you can't have two faces. But, you know, where you also can't have two faces is when you go to commentarymagazine.com and read us, $19.95 for a year's digital subscription, $29.95 gets you everything plus our beautiful monthly magazine. Please join us. Come read us. We'll be back next week with a couple more podcasts. We have a debate next week, and we'll just see how low we can go. So for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.